welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. This is the fifth year of our show. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment. And every week on Connect the Dots, I connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and what's going on in our total environment, in our social structures, in our communities, in our food, water, air, and earth, in the bigger society, the way we regulate, legislate, promote, market, believe, think, and are taught to believe and think, and how that affects our own well-being, that of our families, and the ecological balance of planet Earth. Every week we talk about this on Connect the Dots with different thought leaders, authors, experts, advocates, and a whole range of other terrific folk who are engaged in promoting well-being on multiple different levels. And, you know, one of the interesting things about the show and the whole concept of the show, which, by the way, was suggested when I talked about my reporting work by an audio engineer at our host station, Progressive Radio Network, the theme of Connect the Dots, is that, you know, all of us function, you know, our life today is so complex and we live in an interconnected universe and world. And so, you know, everyone kind of picks up a piece of that and sort of discusses it in depth, which is what the different people who come on this show do. But what I also try to do in our conversations, as regular listeners know, is connect the dots with a whole range of other things, because we see the same stories playing out on multiple levels. And that's one of the reasons I'm very fascinated to present today's guest and discuss what she's up to, which is very groundbreaking and sort of meeting with great popular support, yet great societal infrastructural resistance, a theme that may sound quite familiar to regular listeners of this show. Her name is Kelly Brogan, MD, and she's written a terrific book called A Mind of Your Own, which really takes on the pharmaceutical establishment around the treatment of depression and the, you know, the medicalization of our moods and mental states and attitudes about ourselves. And that will be what we are discussing today, her book and the interesting media shutdown blackout on it, which has not stopped it from rising on the bestseller list with a lot of popular support and internet dissemination and dialogue, which we'll also talk about on today's show. Before I bring Kelly on, I just want to say that this is an area that's always interested me tremendously, in part because I come from a family with many neurologists and psychiatrists in it, which is how I got into integrative medicine almost three decades back. Was kind of going, I wonder what alternatives there may be to this. And we don't call them alternatives anymore. We call them health care and approaches to health at work. But even back in 2008, when I was the first health reporter on the Huffington Post, I did a piece on a study that found that antidepressants, so widely prescribed, don't actually work for most people. And, you know, what's going on there? So I'm sure we'll be discussing that with Kelly today, too. So I just want to give a warm welcome to you, Kelly Brogan, here to Connect the Dots.
Such a pleasure, and I feel like I almost have to thank everyone who allows me to open my mouth for having the courage to to create a space for this kind of discussion. So thank you for having me.
Well, I'm delighted to have you, and this is the space where all of these kinds of discussions happen and where things that are marginalized by the mainstream due to the pushback of various industries get talked about, get disseminated, and finally reach the public despite this horrible time where we have corrupted media blacking out topics that oppose their sponsors. Mm-hmm. So before we get into the substance of your book, which I look forward to talking about in depth with you, could you, you know, the book is about a natural approach to depression that sounds like a no-brainer, but for some reason The way you present it and the way you're taking something on in this book has led to, or maybe because they think your voice is going to be a more widespread one than others who may have in the past proposed natural cures of various kinds, you're getting this media blackout. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on?
Sure. So, you know, I was not raised as a hippie. You know, I'm not a New Ager. I very much, I come from a family that reveres the medical model, and I went to medical school and became a psychiatrist in order to prescribe. You know, I very much believe that the health of all humanity was just, you know, one better prescription away, you know, and it is because I think I am so dyed in the wool that the left turn that I took is very provocative, you know, for many people. And in this way, I sort of think of myself as a bridge back to common sense, back to ancient wisdom, back to some awakening that so many of us are coming to around a kind of approach to health that seems to make a lot more sense than the many, many, many Band-Aids we're putting on the festering wounds of humanity today. So I'm in this position where I have the opportunity to speak truths that have been spoken by Ayurveda and Chinese medicine and naturopaths and chiropractors for many, many decades, if not centuries and beyond. But I didn't expect to land a book deal because so much of what I have to say really across the board, so I don't take on, you know, just antidepressants. You know, I have researched for almost, you know, a decade now. I haven't left one stone unturned when it comes to conventional medicine. So this is a very comprehensive, you know, potentially undermining, piece of work. And I thought it would be difficult for me to get a book deal somehow, some way, maybe because when you're aligned with, you know, the truth, doors open for you. I landed, you know, quite a powerful advance, and because of that, I knew that HarperCollins would be putting their weight behind the publicity of this book. And so it was about a month before it was to launch, and, you know, at this point, all of their, you know, sort of VIP authors have been on all, have already booked all the shows and been on most of them. So Dr. Oz and, you know, Rachel Ray and 2020 and Today Show and 60 Minutes and all of the CEOs of the top news stations and networks in New York City, which is where I practice, asked for galleys. So they heard about the book, they knew about it, and the galleys went all the way up to the top. And that's when we started getting no's back. And sometimes we were sort of strung along for weeks at a time, which is also very unusual. And, you know, my publicist, you know, at Harper was beside herself. I mean, they just have never seen something like this. And I knew that this was going to happen. I warned them that we wouldn't be able to rely on mainstream media. And you know what? It's sort of ethically correct, you know, that I not use mainstream platforms to get out a message that really is in stark conflict with everything they represent. And so I'm not interested in demonizing them. I'm not even really interested in demonizing the pharmaceutical industry because it's a business. We all together have created this culture and society that values business in this way. We are just as much responsible for what's going on, each and every one of us, as they are. So I don't think it's helpful to sort of, and I spent many years in this mentality, to sort of, you know, feel victimized by an industry that's evil. It's a business, and when we forget that and we think that they're here to take care of us, you know, then we get upset. But really, mm-hmm. they're, you know, they're just doing what they need to do to keep their shareholders happy. And so they can't put me on, you know, on Dr. Oz talking about what I have discovered over, you know, the years of my research about the questions, like you mentioned, around efficacy of some of these medications or safety, and then have there be a Zoloft ad, you know, 10 minutes later. It's just not going to, it's not going to fly. So I have booked not 1 minute of mainstream airtime, not 1 minute. Mm-hmm. And so it was dead in the water. You know, the book was essentially dead in the water. And what's so beautiful, I literally, you know, was like weeping on the train this morning because I feel so moved by the community that's rising up around this. And it's actually the greatest gift, right? It's always how life works. It's like just when you feel you've been delivered a challenge, it turns into exactly what you needed. And so to me, what we really need, if we're going to move this, you know, this kind of truth forward and create a space for it to exist, is for people to come together in this kind of solidarity. So, you know, the fact that the book is what it, Amazon literally just sold out of the book. It's an incredible thing, and it's all because of grassroots awareness. So it's sort of a new model for dissemination of information. It's very cool.
What was it in the book that was a turnoff for them? I mean, just give us a you know, some kind of idea of how
some
you
ideas,
see
yeah.
that.
So it's again, it's not an anti-pharma book. In fact, the subtitle used to be, when I, you know, when we first put it out, What Women Can Do for Themselves That Big Pharma Can't. And, mm-hmm. and we changed it really because we started to feel into the message of the book and the energy of it as it was being completed. And we felt mm-hmm. that no longer represented it. And I've also undergone like quite a personal and spiritual evolution in the past year. Largely induced by the death of my mentor, Nicholas Gonzalez, and, you know, I've come to a different energy about it. I don't want to fight. You know, I don't. I don't want to be, you know, rallying my soldiers for war. I really want to come from a place of awe and inspiration around what is still possible, you know, to create hope. And so it's not an anti-pharma book, and what it is a pro-informed consent and pro-power of natural health. You know, that's what this is meant to leave you with. It's meant to be empowering and exciting. And if it were just an anti-pharma book, like so many of the books I have actually read that inspired a lot of this material, it would leave you with a feeling of emptiness and panic, right? So that's not the idea. But what I think ended up being the material in there that was so provocative was that I touched on a broad swath of pharmaceuticals, you know, from statins to vaccines to antibiotics to Tylenol and Advil, you know, birth control. I really, you know, I really was comprehensive in my expression of concern around undisclosed risks that these medications carry in an age where it's Russian roulette. Because our bodies are so burdened with toxicants that one medication can literally be the tipping point, you know, beyond which you are never able to retrieve a life that you knew. And so if we can't identify who is going to be vulnerable to these risks, it becomes unethical to prescribe them, at least without discussing all of the known risks, right? So that's sort of the least that we can do, and then just sort of leave it in the patient's hands with the very big question of whether or not they will be the one. Because statistics are, you know, interesting, but in the end, you know, if you're the 1%, you don't care that 99% didn't suffer, right? It becomes instantly collapses the wave function, right? So, you know, I think it's really the comprehensive nature of the look. And I've always tapped into what I call pan-activism, so like a type of activism around many different arenas from, you know, food integrity and the risks of pesticides and genetic modification, you know, to the importance of home birth, to my concerns around pharmaceuticals on the whole without carve-out or exception, including mandated pharmaceuticals. You know, mm-hmm. I have a broad spectrum of concern.
I was going to ask about that because of when you mentioned genetic predisposition. So, I think that's really a very important message. And, you know, I have also actually written about mandated pharmaceuticals specifically in line with the fact that they may be indicated for some and incredibly harmful to others. And unless we take other factors into account, we really don't know who that might be, and in effect, it is a Russian roulette, and that is a kind of, it exists, you know, to a lesser or greater degree around any, you know, like potent substance, and many of these are synthetic, and they act on different pathways of the body, which may be either overloaded with toxins, which is another big theme on this show, or else they may be malfunctioning or low PAR functioning for genetic reasons, and none of that screening is done, and instead we do a universal kind of prescription and everybody
exactly.
is on everything, and then you kind of have these sort of surprise, and they're statistically present in the study, which was determining efficacy. There's a certain percentage of people may experience a side effect. The thing is, we're not discerning, and we don't really examine who that may be ahead of the time, so it places everyone in a reactive position. Oops,
exactly.
It happened to me, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, and that's the most difficult way to learn, right? If I could, you know, I can't tell you how many of my patients express this intense remorse, saying, I wish if I had only known what I know now when I filled that first prescription. And that's the worst way to learn, right? There,
yes.
The beauty of the internet, there's so much beauty to it, while there is also a lot to be concerned about. But the beauty is that the information is out there. It's out there. This is the true democratization of information flow. And so you can learn in advance. If you're not informed by your doctor about the things that are in this book, you know, well, you have the book, and you have many, many resources on the internet that echo a broader availability of science that you may not have been aware of. So it's changing, and there need to be fewer and fewer victims, I guess, is the call to action here.
Well, you know, the thing is, I appreciate your, liking to do positive messaging and all the rest of it. But the fact is, you know, and the message of empowerment is important. At the same time, I take the healthcare, and I'm speaking here of the integrative and functional healthcare system, which is the only one that the one that I have covered is one of the five initial health journalists, one of two women who were in that position
wow.
25 years ago. And having covered that field, promoted it, used it in my own life, befriended and have a whole network, not only of professional colleagues, but also of personal healer friends, in that domain. But one of the things is that I also feel that we've done a great job of giving the message of personal empowerment, and of course we're all individual, our approach to healthcare must so be as well,
yeah.
Because in other words, if the side effect hits me but not you or whatever, you know, then we need to self-select for that kind of thing. At the same time, more and more people are, and I don't think we have to be cringing psychologically and afraid of the term. I think we have to kind of face up to the harm that has been done, not categorizing people as lifelong victims, but have been without, due care placed on the receiving end of these driven, profit-driven initiatives that can confer health harm, economic harm, can actually, as you mentioned, undermine our food supply and can pollute the earth itself. So, I don't want to, through the fear of a label called victim, deny the fact that a lot of people are receiving the raw end of the stick here, and really individual action and self-empowerment around addressing your own health, I really regard as a baseline, and it's been the one that I've personally acted on, for decades now. But it's also important to join with others, and this is the other thing I like about your book initiative a lot, and change some of these things, because all of our healthy prescriptions, will be much easier to act upon and will be more accessible to more people rather than just
That's right.
a certain niche of the well-to-do
yes.
If we collectively get our butts up, and act upon, initiatives that protect our food and our health and our environment. And in fact, today, I just want to give a shout out. There's a very key initiative going on today, which is there is an effort in Congress to prevent, labeling of GMO foods is preferred by 90% of the general public. Corrupted, lobbyists and others have leaned on our legislators and public officials, and they are actually trying to remove today, they're voting on it today, folks, the right to know what's in our food, and that extends both to GMOs and as well as to foreign imports and a host of other products. And in fact, we need to do more labeling, not only of GMOs and food, but of beauty care products and, a whole host of other things. We need more of that, not less. So I'm going to urge all our listeners to please, you know, go to Food Democracy Now today and make some calls. Call, you know, because it's like this is also empowerment, and I think we need to extend that individual empowerment, you know, to the collective decisions we make as a society. So I'll get off my ad soapbox
for
the moment.
No, I love that you brought that up, and I love, you know, obviously even the name of your show, which is, you know, that we can sort of get overly wed, you know, to our pet cause, right, to whatever sort of gets us fired up. But the truth is, if we don't start to step back and look at how informed consent is being compromised in all of these arenas, like you said, in the cosmetic arena, in the chemical industry, in big agriculture, in medicine, you know, it's we deserve the right to the available information. We it's absolutely unethical for it to be, you know, filtered through a profit-driven little pinhole. So what you're pointing out is that these are all connected issues, and we can demand, you know, a level of transparency that doesn't exist today.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I feel that your area, which has to do with the ability to, you know, work with your own mind and the balance of your own mind and your moods and your feelings and your emotions, and not use medication that's going to dull that and may have much worse side effects besides. I would love to hear from you why so many people, and especially women, are experiencing depression in these times. Like, what does that represent biologically, psychologically, sociologically?
I love that question. So we know that depression is now the number one cause of disability. So you were talking about, you know, sort of the victimization. And we have many different factors. Like anything, the truth is complex, right? So it's not as simple as more people are depressed. It's not as simple as more people are being diagnosed. It's actually both, right? So the reason that more people, and specifically women, are struggling with what is being labeled as depression, which of course I discuss, is just a symptom. You know, we need to divest ourselves of the illusion that depression is some heritable, discrete disease entity that, you know, will persist until you die and can only be managed with a chemical fix. Right? Mm-hmm. That is absolutely a myth. So when we shed that, then what we're left with is that depression is a symptom just like a fever is a symptom. Right? Mm-hmm. And what it's telling us is that there is an imbalance. So it's an invitation to explore the nature of that imbalance. And while there are many, many, many different sources, right, just like a fever, you could be, you know, responding to myriad different microbial, you know, invaders, let's say, depression can arise from many different bodily imbalances. So I focus a lot on this concept that is called in the literature evolutionary mismatch, which is the idea that we have been evolving for, you know, 2.5 million years, and only in the past 100, 150 years have our day-to-day exposures from our food supply, from our chemical exposures, from sleep to sun exposure, and certainly, you know, to stress, to a very different kind of stress. They have these, you know, sort of stimuli have changed so dramatically in the past 100 years that our bodies are working overtime to adapt. And part of the way they adapt is to recruit a signaling system to get all, you know, everyone on deck. And that signaling system is the inflammatory system. So that's why we see all of these chronic diseases of the modern era, you know, whether it's heart disease or diabetes or cancer or autoimmunity, and we see them skyrocketing. I mean, there are 100 autoimmune diseases now that didn't exist 200 years ago. And so we are seeing how the body is in a response. And there's no doubt, I have infinite faith in this organism, right? There's no doubt that given a little more time, we would probably adapt. I actually do believe that. But right now we're in the uncomfortable bridge space, and I think it's actually, you know, going to push us to the point where we have to compromise, you know, where we have to begin to see that we cannot lord over nature and win. It doesn't work that way. And that's the beauty of, right, like the microbiome. That's the beauty of learning that what we thought was the enemy, what we thought was outside of us, is actually all up in us. You know, it's all up in there. And so we cannot fight thinking it's out there without also fighting ourselves fundamentally. So there's a lot of poetry in what's coming out in the science itself today. But of course, it takes so long for it to trickle down. So I focus a lot on depression as being a manifestation of that. And in the literature, it's called sickness syndrome, and all of the symptoms of depression are essentially meant to slow you down and put you in a place of recovery. And, of course, we're meant to get right back to work, right? There's no time for slowing down. There's no time for letting it all fall apart. So, you know, in this effort to suppress symptoms, to reject that invitation, you know, to change, we are just getting our patients back to work. You know, and there are many other possible drivers of depression, including, you know, a psycho-spiritual mismatch. You know, that how could it be that, you know, the way that some people are living today could potentially give you a sense of vitality and freedom in this life experience? It's would be ridiculous. Depression is almost the only appropriate response to the, to how disconnected so many of us are, you know, to our communities, to our, you know, selves, to our sense of purpose. So there's a lot of nuance to it, but then there's also the fact that women are prescribed reflexively medication almost 67% more than men, right? So if you're a woman and you present to your internist and you feel like you've had a lot of brain fog and, you know, a lot of anxiety, having some trouble sleeping, and you also have a lot of, like, you know, digestive problems, maybe you have alternating constipation and diarrhea, and you have a little bit of a rash on one side of your leg, and you've had some hair loss recently, if your doctor is ill-equipped to take the deep dive, you know, biologically into what might be this, you know, non-discrete, more complex presentation, which is almost always, you know, immune and inflammatory in nature. If your doctor is ill-equipped and or doesn't have time because of the medical system we have set up, then, and because your doctor is probably a good person, right, and probably does want to help you, the Occam's razor to helping you in that moment is going to feel like handing you a Prozac prescription to meet your distress, right, head on. And so this is how I end up seeing so many patients who have been carelessly, unfortunately, medicated, not for a couple of months for a quick fix, but for the quick fix that turned into like 20 years of treatment that nobody, you know, attempted to intervene on. So it's both overdiagnosis and reckless prescribing, and it's also that women are struggling today. You know, they're struggling in ways that are not acknowledged by, the, you know, anything that I learned in my conventional training.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, I had this experience of going to sort of a week-long workshop, and there were a whole lot of kind of arbitrary rules, and it's in keeping with what you're saying, because we, you know, there's no space, there's no economic breathing room. Everyone has to kind of be in a fast-paced forced march in order to, you know, stay where they need to be in terms of these highly pressured economic drivers that are happening in our world nowadays. So that affects both the healthcare provider, and it affects the person, and it affects their family, it affects their workplace, it kind of affects everybody. I was at this seminar, which the purpose of the seminar was to take a whole bunch of corporate mid-level managers, and actually, ironically, this was prior to the BP oil spill, which I covered for Huffington, many, like 5 or 8 years prior. These were BP mid-level managers, and it was basically designed to kind of force march them in a few days through any childhood or other issues that could have that could be limiting their productivity. And so they were kind of, instead of the sort of you know, kind of a safe and nurturing holding environment, this was something where you were kind of doing it. You know, the people participating were doing it for their bosses, and therefore they kind of had to participate.
So interesting,
and at the same time, they were like trying to open up to, you know, getting healed. And it was a very odd combination. It was like a case of healing goes corporate gone bad, I would say. I was there as a reporter. But one of the things that happened is that they, you know, in an effort to kind of, their effort to create a container was more like EST or the Forum, where, you know, there were a whole lot of very tight rules, such as when you could go to the bathroom. And so, of course, you know, this immediately brought up rebellion. That was part of the purpose of it. And, you know, so there was a lot of power struggles going on about that. And I would say about, I don't know, maybe 90% of those present just docilely accepted what was given. And then there were 10 people who kind of became the outliers who were, you know, resisting. They became the resistance. And I gravitated toward that group because it was more interesting. And what ended up happening, though, was when the resistance, one of the things was that one couldn't, for example, although there was nobody locking the door, and there was no explicit statement that, oh, it's the dinner hour, you must stay here in the room, when it was proposed that the 10 people, myself included, go out and get a meal and kind of get a different perspective on this thing, no one felt they could leave the room. And none of them felt they could leave the room. The group included a couple of doctors. And what I found out in conversation with them as this decision was made was that every single person there was on an antidepressant.
Wow.
So, you know, one of the things that struck me from a lovely article that our dear friend Sayer G of Green Med Info wrote about, you know, your work in A Mind of Your Own, was your, you know, kind of conflating or noting the connection between suppression, as in suppressive medicine, oppression, as in, you know, an oppressive system of some kind, which is, you know, what this particular group was, and depression, where people kind of turn it in on themselves and lose energy, et cetera. I'd love to hear you talk more about that connection in light of what I just shared.
Yes. So what I've come to realize is that when, you know, when women come to my office, and I have a women's health practice, well, not only because my conventional training actually pushed me in that direction in terms of specialization, but you know, they're interested in managing their symptoms, right, because of what you're alluding to, which is this mandate to maintain functionality, right, because we make no room culturally, spiritually, or psychologically in this country for suffering. Suffering is a bad thing, right? And in fact, every native culture, you know, to this planet appreciates that there are rites of passage, that there is vital evolution that comes through pain, and that suffering, the more you resist it, the worse it gets, right? So we've lost that level of consciousness because we've lost our very many vital connections to a sense of, you know, an inner compass around navigating life on this planet. But so I can't blame them that all they care about is like, when am I going to be able to sleep normally? You know, when am I going to be able to stop crying every day? And when am I going to be able to multitask quite as much as I want to? What I am interested in is not that. You know, I know that we can get, you know, within a month of radical lifestyle change, those symptoms go away. This is not rocket science. This is not even challenging most of the time. But what I'm interested in is then escorting them through the door, right? So not just sort of like getting them back up and running more quickly than, you know, an antidepressant would if it could, which, of course, every practicing psychiatrist will tell you it takes 6 to 8 weeks for an antidepressant to take effect, right? So give me that month, and let's see what we can do with it. But what I'm more interested in is transformation. So the kind of transformation that I'm interested in comes from relinquishing fear around what these symptoms mean and what they might mean for your life that needs to just be humming along, right? So relinquishing fear and adopting a new posture towards the life unfoldment, right? So that actually means that you have to develop a sense of connection to your own agency and your own internal power and a confidence in the fact that you're not going to constantly reach outside of yourself for help support and remediation of your struggle, right? Like, I'm not interested in having very long-term patients. I'm interested in, you know, escorting them through this door, giving them the tools, and then pushing them out the door because I know they can do it. I have total faith in that every single person can do this if they are ready and they have the desire and the will. So the problem is that you cannot, in my experience, you cannot access the parts of your psyche that you need to become more fully who you are when you are medicated psychiatrically. Mm-hmm. And this is not only my perception, but if you look into the grassroots movements online, you know, Beyond Meds or Platform Mad in America, you will hear story after story after story of people who underwent massive psycho-spiritual transformations only after they came off of medication, right? Mm-hmm. And so I don't think we have a great way yet. You know, maybe it's because, you know, fluoride and Prozac calcifies the pineal gland, you know, our seat of intuition. I don't know what it is. We don't have a good explanation for what it is about these medications because we don't even really know what they do. We'd like it to be really simplistic and reductionist in the one pill, you know, for one ill model where they just sort of do one thing, like all Prozac does is raise up your low serotonin a bit. But, of course, that's not the way biochemistry works, right? The symphony of the body, it's like a, you know, I've talked about, it's like a web, spider web. You can't just pull one thread. That's not how it works. So we don't really know what they do, but what they functionally do, and maybe it's just because of the belief system underlying it. I'm very passionate about the role of the placebo effect, and I think that the belief system underlying taking a psychiatric medication is such that it is fundamentally disempowering. It is fundamentally a statement that says, my body is broken. My brain is broken. It cannot heal itself. I need this to get myself up and functioning. That is the most important thing. It's all I care about. So maybe just when you make that statement, I don't know, that might be sufficient to keep you from moving through a phase of your life that you need to move through to listen to the message and the call of the symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great stuff. That is so powerful, and that makes such complete sense. And so the whole, what you're getting to here is the whole basic psychological set and the inherent and you're speaking as a psychiatrist, you know, it's the disempowerment of the take a pill and chill approach to health. It's
yeah,
the absolute
I like that.
Rock bottom fundamental
slogan
of it. You know, it's interesting because, gosh, I mean, I've known Mehmet Oz for many years because, you know, we've both been in this thing for a long time, way before his show and everything. I've interviewed and featured him, and I know him, right? And in fact, I remember him speaking about that when he initially, you know, founded the integrative medical program at the hospital at Columbia Presbyterian, which he was really a pioneer in the founding of that, and that is actually his phrase, take a pill and chill, you know. And so I am just simply astounded, and I just wanted, you know, I want to pause because you've gotten to the absolutely fundamental disempowerment and giveaway of ourselves that we do or feel is the only option. And it really does go down to these core beliefs. And at the same time, and I thank you for talking about that because I think, you know, you can have a mental tussle over concepts and science, right? Although the science is pretty clear. But, you know, if you don't factor in the beliefs and attitudes that we're absorbing and drinking in that then make us do these things or predispose us, no one's going to make us, but that predispose us to go along and feel that that's our only option, you know, then you do have this core disempowerment in relation to our health, in relation to our ability to shape our world and our society in relationship to everything. So, you know, I really want to thank you for that. And I also want to note with surprise that Dr. Oz, you know, who targeted this take a pill and chill approach and being a pioneer of founding an academic integrative medical unit, you know, is pressured by sponsors, one would guess, and can't even have you on his program.
Right. Even though I promised to do my hair and look really pretty.
Well, you look lovely every time I've ever seen you in person or your photo,
no,
Kelly, you know.
It's the
nature
of the beast.
And that's part of playing that game, too. And the thing is, it's like, you know, we go into the media in order to have a voice, but at a certain time, and that's, of course, not true here on Progressive Radio, but at a certain point, that media influence that we barter for turns around and shapes what we ourselves can say and the original impulse and the original message that we were motivated to reach out and deliver gets transformed by the environment in which we all live and in which the media is run nowadays. So I just want to note that, because it is it's disturbing. I mean, that alone, I'm not a depressive personality. I'm kind of more of a feisty, kind of anxious person who worries about everything in advance, and therefore is, like, you know, greatly suited to be a reporter, because I ferret out the things we should be concerned about, you know, ahead of the curve. But, you know, that when I contemplate that, the fact that somebody goes forth to deliver a message and then their message gets distorted, their healing impulse gets distorted, then I actually feel I feel sad. You know, I feel sad, and
but don't feel sad. That's what's amazing about this, is my book has no business being in the top 25 books out of 8.8 million on the planet right now. It has no business being there, considering I have not done what is normally and always done for best-selling books in this country. The fact that it's there is evidence. It's all the evidence that we need that we are, it's working, you know, that we don't need and we shouldn't need. And again, it's poetically just. I shouldn't be using pharma subsidized outlets to speak about my message, to use them, so to speak, to get my word out. It's not right. So I'm glad actually that it's worked out this way, because for grassroots information, organic, you know, it's organic information dissemination, and for it to actually be like working on a metric that is measurable for moving the needle is awesome. So I actually think it's we're in this bridge window, you know, where we're moving from, you know, an old model to a new model. And I didn't think it would happen this quickly. I mean, when I first got into the activism realm, I cried myself to sleep at night for years. I have two daughters, and all I could think was, what was the matter with me that I ever brought children into this world? Like, it is so impossibly wrong. Everything is so wrong, and we can't fix it. You know, like, we still have DDT, you know, like, in our water. We can't fix it. We're so far gone. But I think that even in that psychology, I neglect what is my fundamental belief, which is that coming together in a space and at a vibration of connectedness and, you know, it sounds so trite to say love, but that's really what it is. It's like an open-heartedness and a lack of fear. That all we need to do then is every single person do that. That's what I realized. It's like what we call N of one medicine, right? It's every single person wakes up and commits, you know, to working on themselves, in bringing themselves into their highest manifestation, and then it's all they have to do. We don't have to war. We don't even have to get on the streets picketing. We just have to hold that space. And I believe it's really, really powerful, and it ends up having, you know, as Rupert Sheldrake says, like a morphic resonant effect. Like, just you being you in this psychology ends up reverberating. And actually, the science from the HeartMath Institute, if you know them, you know, they have done the science to validate that our electromagnetic field, when we are experiencing the emotion of gratitude, you know, that it impacts other people at a distance. And it also brings our own electrophysiology into what's called coherence. So these are the types of things that are neglected when we just think in a binary way about, you know, us versus them, the victims versus the perpetrators, and I was there for a long time. But I actually think something really, really cool is happening, and I'm obviously honored to be any part of it. But it's not about me, it's not about this book, and it's not even really about psychiatry. It's about coming closer to a different kind of energy and a different kind of shared experience. You know, because what we're doing is just not working. I don't think you could meet a single person who feels like we're doing things just right now.
Well, you know, that's true, and I've interviewed Rupert Sheldrake multiple times. I've studied a form that's based on his work that does ancestral healing. I've practiced that for many years, so, you know, I'm
amazing.
Totally with you in that space. At the same time, I'm going to, you know, challenge what you said a little bit, because, you know, we're right now seeing, and I'm just going to take it right up there, we're right now seeing in our political sphere some people who are, you know, as much as I may have had the well-being, the privilege, the economic status, the time to develop certain aspects of myself. You know, we're seeing a group of people who have been economically disenfranchised by societal decisions. Their jobs have gone away. Their middle-class status has been undermined. They don't feel they have a voice. They're desperate. They're frightened. They you know, have been targeted to blame others who are different from themselves and have been programmed through media that maybe we don't listen to or would be disconnected from, and they are being, you know, they're identifying and resonating to someone who is speaking a lot of hatred. So that individual health message of, you know, coming from love in your heart, meditation, yoga, all the rest of it. I'm a trained yoga teacher and have practiced yoga for, I don't know, 30 years or something like that. You know, that work on the individual self when coming from people who, you know, have the wherewithal to do it is also, you know, I think also needs to encompass those who don't. Those who don't have the quality food, more and more of the, you know, we've been, you know, cultivating love, those of us who have the ability to do it, and more people have been disenfranchised. Some of them are still caring people who are looking at caring options and who don't, you know, aren't, you know, prey through negative childhood experiences or whatever else has happened to them to, you know, go right to bigotry and hatred. But there's a very toxic brew psychologically. I mean, Bernie Sanders referred to a mental health problem, which I think was an understatement, but he's the only one to have even mentioned it in one of the debates, you know, among our population. So I don't think that we can just put ourselves in a bubble and you know, hope that if we, you know, kind of vibrate in the right way psychologically, it's going to reach out and affect people who are who've been disadvantaged and who feel, you know, the American dream, the small corner of the American dream that was promised to them has betrayed them.
I hear you. But the issue is that we don't got another choice, right? Because old school activism, you know, flame throwing activism is only exacerbating the situation. It's only going to make it worse for us.
No,
so
I don't agree with that.
The activists
that I've worked with in New York have stopped the poisoning of our water supply through getting a fracking ban, and I have experienced them personally as some of the most caring people in the world.
Exactly.
And I think corporate message that hangs, you know, a bad jacket on activists and calls them angry or whatever is actually part of the programming of disempowerment that we have in our society.
It's true, but it also does then manifest. You know, I have a very large network of activists that I'm in touch with and run groups, you know, involved in grassroots activism. We are not stopping, okay? I am not calling for a cessation of day-to-day work on raising awareness around the truth. But what I am saying and what I have witnessed and what I experienced myself was that if that effort does not come from the right space and it comes from a place of further dominance, need for further dominance, it's only going to keep this afloat. That was my personal revelation, is that I, you know, when there were vaccine mandates passed in California, I cried for a week, literally uncontrollable, because I felt so hopeless and I felt like all of our efforts were not yielding anything. And now look, we've lost our fundamental right to bodily integrity in this country, in America. How is this happening? And I felt a degree of hopelessness that only fueled a rage I thought would never burn out. And what I noticed was the other activists who came from that energy were like self-imploding. Mm-hmm. So what I have learned is that actually it is the responsibility of activists, of people who feel called to mm-hmm. serve on this planet, to yep. actually come in and do that work. And you know mm-hmm. what? This work is not like navel gazing. And by the way, it's available to every single person struggling on this planet to take 3 minutes and feel into some degree of gratitude for what they've got.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's available to everyone. And mm-hmm. that simple experience, again, if you need the data for it, it exists. You know, go mm-hmm. check out the HeartMath Institute. That simple experience shifts your potential. Because the definition of insanity is what? The definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different result. Applying more and more of the broken technology and science to a problem of broken technology and science. So we cannot do that. And so the only alternative I can think of is to feel into our responsibility to our own perspective about this and to come into a place of, you know, open-heartedness about it. Because if you come at this problem and all the many, many problems on this earth with an energy of they're wrong, they're, you know, evil, and this needs to be, you know, suppressed or dominated, while all those things may on some level be valid, I'm telling you, if you come from that energy, you are only going to create more of the same. And it's a subtle but very important truth that I couldn't feel more passionately about. You know, my friend Charles Eisenstein, wrote a book called The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible, and he's a pan-activist, and he is in touch with, you know, thousands of activists around the world. And that's essentially what he argues, is unless you realize that we have all co-created this, you know, we've all made Trump. We've made him. We have yeah. all made it possible for somebody like that to have the power that he does.
I completely agree with that statement.
So we can't.
And I think there's something else here, though. I totally agree with that. I couldn't agree more. And in fact, in talking about Trump on the show today, I didn't talk about Trump. I didn't characterize Trump very much.
Right.
I talked about the population. No. I mean, I have, you know, my own triggers about Trump or whatever. But I talked about the population with whom I empathize.
Yes.
That, you know, have been placed in the condition by a whole bunch of social decisions and things that we have all either tacitly yes. agreed to, not know what it was happening, or in fact, if, you know, benefited from economically, even if only indirectly, and I mm-hmm. include myself in that, mm-hmm. because, you know, anyone who owns a mutual fund is benefiting indirectly, right? So, you know, the very privileges that we enjoy, that I yes. speak of myself, that I have enjoyed, you know, the privileges of education, of living in a nice place, of having access, I do it through an organic food co-op, but to excellent food, healthy food, etc. I also make a priority of it. But all of that also, you know, I have to acknowledge is not widely available. So I have no problem with gratitude. I do feel, and I think, you know, a lot of people feel gratitude for their lives. And I think another part of this is both the space to grieve, which you mentioned earlier, because I think that the rage becomes toxic due to the lack of space and support for grieving losses.
Totally.
And for facing endings. And I also feel that there is a place for acknowledgement and atonement. So where we go, I too. In other words,
yes.
the basis for my empathy is not to say, you idiots, Americans are stupid, you know, et cetera, when I'm looking at people who, you know, have been manipulated, who
yeah.
have had less opportunity, who don't feel any outrage, who maybe are biologically undermined by the poor quality foods they've been eating. You know, I try to look at the whole picture and feel empathy for them, and then if they are in that position and I participated and benefited from some of the social
yes.
choices that put them in that position, then a acknowledgement of my participation and atonement specifically is appropriate, and not just on the universal level of, you know, we all co-create everything, but really personally to do a taking stock. And I think that's really an essential part of this.
It's beautiful mm-hmm. what you're saying. And it also, you know, the point of gratitude in many ways is that it prompts service, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you feel into an energy of abundance, you actually want to change and shift and give back. I mean, the people, the activists that I know who come from the place you're talking about, who come from that space of like, of gratitude for what they've got and experienced and had offered to them, they give back. You know, mm-hmm. they do serve, and they do take their time, energy, and money and put it back into helping to heal the problem. So it's exactly what you're describing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's really interesting to talk about this range of issues, you know, with a holistic psychiatrist and a woman. So, you know, I think your perspective is really fascinating. I hope that a mind of your own continues to skyrocket through social media, and I want to encourage listeners who've enjoyed our conversation to go to their local bookstore or order on Amazon, or preferably go to your local bookstore. If they don't have a mind of your own in stock, you can ask them to order it and purchase it there. You can give it to your friends, suggest it to your friends, and participate in a grassroots effort on behalf of a healing book to look at greater depth at the complexity of, you know, how we wound up with depression as the biggest worldwide problem, and where the resources are for recovery and healing. You know, our guest today has been Kelly Brogan, MD, who is the author of A Mind of Your Own. And I just want to say, Kelly, it's just been a terrific conversation. I've had so much fun.
I so enjoyed it.
Talking with you, and I see why a number of my close colleagues and friends have raved about you and your work, and, you know, justifiably so. So, you know, it's really interesting because your kind of big book, you know, usually just kind of, there's not an opportunity for this full range of conversation because it's just kind of, this is the healing path. This is what you do. I mean, you have stepped
into...
I
feel like we didn't even talk about the book.
Well, I felt like we were talking about the book all throughout.
There's
but
a lot of good stuff in it. Yeah, no, that's funny. No, I hear you.
Yeah, no, but actually, I think that for this audience, we've had exactly the conversation
yes.
that should... And I would personally recommend it because I do know... people who not only, you know, we all at various times, and I think it's really, it's not that women alone, but it certainly is a women's issue. And I think, you know, women have to deal, even no matter how successful some may be. You know, women have to deal with a lot of crimps in our empowerment. I mean, I feel like a lot of people identify with Hillary Clinton because she is like another woman like me who's you know, had to fight to make her way. I personally, even though I'm of a similar generation and I'm not a multimillionaire and I've had, you know, like lower grade, some might say, though in my life they've been significant struggles, and she has, you know, but I'm not really into her war orientation
mm-hmm.
at all,
mm-hmm.
so I'm not a supporter of hers.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a better clue is to get a mind of your own and really deal with some of these issues and look at the global problems. So I just want to thank you, Kelly Brogan, again for being on our show. Listeners, go out and get a mind of your own. And
thank you, Kelly. Wonderful talking to you.
All right, okay, listeners, be well until our next edition of Connect the Dots. Next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Thank you.